Coming up, Lucky Severson on helping doctors have end-of-life discussions with their patients in order to avoid aggressive treatments that the patients don't want. Plus, this week's terrorist bombing in Istanbul was near two important religious sites. We look at their significance. And
on truth we stand.
This Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, Kim Lawton catches up with the group Sweet Honey in the Rock, which has been singing about racial inequality and social justice for more than 40 years.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Hari Srinivasan, sitting in for Bob Abernathy. Religious groups had mixed reactions to President Barack Obama's final State of the Union address this week. In his wide-ranging speech, the president addressed criminal justice reform, climate change, gun violence, and immigration reform. He also directly addressed religious bigotry.
When politicians insult Muslims, whether abroad or our fellow citizens, when a mosque is vandalized, or a kid is called names, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong.
Muslim and interfaith leaders gave the president high marks for rejecting what they described as Islamophobic rhetoric in politics. In her Republican response to the State of the Union speech, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley also stressed the importance of faith and religious freedom. In a significant move, top leaders of the Worldwide Anglican Communion this week sanctioned the Episcopal Church for its recent actions in support of same-sex marriage. The Communion is a body of 38 regional jurisdictions, including the U.S.-based Episcopal Church and more conservative churches in the Global South. The Anglican leaders said the Episcopal Church's actions had impaired the Communion. Under the sanctions, for the next 3 years, the Episcopal Church will not be able to represent the Communion at ecumenical and interfaith bodies or take part in decision-making on issues of doctrine.
Jesus of Nazareth.
The Syrian government and insurgent groups granted permission for more humanitarian aid to enter the country after widespread reports of starvation and malnutrition. The town of Madaya, controlled by rebels and encircled by pro-government forces, has been particularly hard hit. At least 28 patients at a clinic have starved to death, according to the nonprofit group Doctors Without Borders. Faith-based aid agencies called for sustained access to ensure permanent humanitarian aid. More than 250,000 Syrians have lost their lives in almost 5 years of conflict. Amid growing anti-immigrant sentiment in many parts of the world, Pope Francis this week called for bold and creative new solutions. In a speech to the Vatican Diplomatic Corps, he said humanity must not let security fears override respect for the dignity of all people. Also this week, Francis's first book as Pope was simultaneously released in 80 countries. Its title is The Name of God is Mercy. At the Vatican, Oscar-winning actor Roberto Benigni helped promote the book. He said he's an enthusiastic supporter of the Pope. On Sunday, Francis is scheduled to visit Rome's historic Great Synagogue. He will be the third pope to do so. In 1986, St. John Paul II became the first modern pope to visit a synagogue. Benedict XVI also visited there. Jewish immigration to Israel from Western Europe reached an all-time high last year. According to the nonprofit group, the Jewish Agency, in 2015, close to 10,000 Western European Jews immigrated to Israel. The vast majority came from France as a result of a rise in anti-Semitic attacks, the agency said. One of the largest Protestant denominations in the United States placed five Israeli banks on a list of companies that it will not invest in because of human rights violations. The Pension Board of the United Methodist Church said it boycotted the banks as part of an international effort to pressure Israel economically over the Palestinian issue. The banks help finance settlement construction in what the church considers illegally occupied Palestinian territories. Jewish leaders have criticized the actions, saying they do nothing to advance peace in the region. Christians were in more danger in 2015 than at any other time in modern history, according to the nonprofit Open Doors USA, which tracks Christian persecution around the world. At a press conference, leaders said 2,400 churches were destroyed or damaged, and more than 7,000 Christians killed for faith-related reasons. The State Department's point man for religious freedom, Ambassador David Saperstein, also spoke.
Every one of the numbers represented in this report is a human being.
The group said North Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and Pakistan were among the most dangerous places in the world to be a Christian. Now, many people who don't have end-of-life discussions with their doctors receive aggressive treatment in hospitals that their doctors wouldn't want for themselves. Part of the problem is that the vast majority of doctors don't feel comfortable having these conversations and aren't trained. Lucky Severson talks with leading Stanford palliative care experts.
Robert Gill suffers from Kennedy's disease and is receiving palliative care at a VA hospital in Palo Alto, California.
Kennedy's disease is like ALS, except ALS is fast. You die quick. My case, it's very slow.
So what does an up day look like compared to a down day?
Well, an up day is I'm feeling good. I'm not in pain. I'm just happy to be alive.
Gil is a Navy veteran and a retired operations manager. He has decided he doesn't want to spend the last days of his life tethered to machines and receiving all the treatments modern medical science has to offer.
Some people want to pity themselves, and others want to just say, move on, enjoy life.
I think the biggest challenge is people don't really want to make plans and have discussions because the topic is so threatening to them. And so what happens is, because they don't plan for it, they are subjected to treatments that are A, not helpful, and B, not what they want.
Dr. Vijay Periyakoil is a nationally recognized Stanford University palliative and hospice care specialist. She says that far too many of the 2.6 million Americans projected to die this year will die in a hospital, even though a majority would rather die at home.
Dying is not being in the ICU, 20 tubes coming out of you, beeping everywhere, families outside, doctors are rounding with their computers. That's not what dying should be. Dying is a social, family, personal event. We really need to free dying from the hospital and take it back into the community where it belongs.
It turns out the vast majority of American doctors don't want to end their lives in a hospital either. Dr. Philip Pizzo is Dean Emeritus at the Stanford School of Medicine.
Anywhere from 80 to 95% of them say they want to die outside the hospital. They want to die at home. They want to have their family around them. They don't want to be on life support systems. And they want to have coverage for their pain.
Okay, how about you?
Absolutely, I feel very much the same way. And I've thought very carefully about that in terms of my care. And my wife and I have had very clear discussions about that. And we've had those discussions with our family as well.
Dr. Pizzo co-chaired the Institute of Medicine Committee that produced the 2014 Dying in America report, which strongly recommended end-of-life conversations with palliative care for all patients with serious illnesses.
There is a tipping point in every illness where the treatment becomes more burdensome than the disease itself, at which point you're keeping the body alive. The person may not really recognize their family. They may not know who they are. They may never, ever come back to the person they used to be. And at that point, then you have to pause and say, what am I doing here?
Dr. Josh Wilfong, a Stanford Palliative Care and Hospice Fellow, says if he had an incurable disease, he would only take treatments that would allow him to live comfortably.
The hospital is a situation where people just lose their dignity. They wear gowns, they lie in bed all day. They're in a way, dehumanized.
It's not only the loss of dignity, the cost of end-of-life care is overwhelming our medical system.
The U.S. spends about 2.5 times the average of most developed countries on health care, and end-of-life care in this country represents a disproportionate share of that expense. Almost 80% of the cost of the final year of life are spent in the last month on intensive, aggressive treatments many patients don't want.
Dr. Piso says the impact on healthcare costs is going to get much worse.
We are literally on the cusp. In the next 15 years, 20% of the population in the United States is going to be 65 years or older.
And the way things have been going, most of those patients 65 and older will never have an end-of-life discussion. That's a finding of a major study by Dr. Vijay, that 99% of doctors don't like to do them.
It's not easy to sit down with a family or a child who may face end of life and have that kind of honest dialogue. You need to be taught how to do that.
Medical school trained me to go out there and save lives and do everything I possibly can. So it's much easier for me to say, let me do one more test.
Our healthcare system has so many perverse incentives that lead to doing more rather than less. And one of the things that that does is not permit physicians or other care providers to have enough time to really be able to sit down and take the time to listen and truly appreciate what the preferences of the family or the individual is about.
Since doctors were not initiating these conversations, Dr. Vijay created the Stanford Letter Project to allow patients and their families to say what matters most to them at the end of their lives. Michael White's brother Jerry recently died of cancer in a hospice. Now the retired firefighter wants to prepare for his own death in case he can't speak for himself.
So how do you make medical decisions in your family?
My wife would decide. She knows how I am about quality of life.
That if your heart were to stop,
yes.
Do you want us to attempt to resuscitate or restart your heart? Or do you want us to allow you to go gently?
No, I definitely do not want to be resuscitated.
Okay. Would you want to be on a breathing machine?
No.
For example, Dr. Vijay talks about end of life to just about anyone who will listen. Here, she's speaking to a large gathering of nurses, one of whom relates her experience with an 18-year-old patient who was grateful to have a candid conversation about his end of life.
That he was just so wise, hearing that he was dying and hearing what it meant and hearing what they could offer him. And everybody kind of left, including his mom, and he looked at me, and he had never, like, looked me in the eyes, and he had never said thank you, and he did both of those things. And then he asked for a hug, and I hugged him, and we both cried.
It's truly a privilege to be able to be there at the bedside of a dying patient and be there for the family. I've taken care of thousands and thousands of patients, and in every single situation, you learn something that you did not know before.
This is Chaplain Mark Goodwin.
Many times, if it's a spiritual question, they're asking what's going to happen to my soul, what's going to happen to my essence or me when I die. I really try to help them draw on their own spiritual understandings and so they can get to a place of peace with that.
I've always wore my religion in my heart, and only my heart. Nobody knew about my religion. But since coming here, I just had a visit this morning by the chaplain. And I have about 4 visits a week. And I enjoy them.
Dr. Vijay is heartened, some might even say excited, that her letter writing project is catching on in other parts of the country. That will be good news to Dr. Piso, whose report, Dying in America, was not very optimistic.
I think the headline, unfortunately, was that our approach to end-of-life care in the United States is still pretty broken, and that we have a lot of work to do.
One reason doctors have not been conducting end-of-life discussions is that they take time and the doctors were not compensated. But as of 2016, Medicare will reimburse doctors who do take the time. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Palo Alto, California.
This week's ISIS-linked bombing in Istanbul took place near Hagia Sophia and the Blue Mosque, two very important religious sites. Ottoman scholar Scott Rank, who lives in Turkey, described the monument's significance for Christians and Muslims.
What we see right behind us was the greatest Christian structure on earth and the largest church from when it was built in 537 until 1520. The Hagia Sophia means in Greek holy wisdom, built in honor of the Logos, or the second person of the Trinity, which is Jesus. Pilgrims, scholars, millions of Christians over the years came to this building. The Crusaders stopped here on the way to the Holy Land, so anyone interested in exploring the international dimensions of Christianity would have had to have come through here. Until it was conquered by the Ottoman Turks in 1453, this was as important, if not more so, in Christendom than St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. When the Ottoman Turks conquered Constantinople in 1453, this building was the last place of refuge for the Byzantine Greeks. It was immediately turned into a mosque and became the most important imperial mosque in the Ottoman Empire. It remained so until the Blue Mosque was built in 1606, which is directly across from the Hagia Sophia. The treatment of the Muslim Ottoman Empire to Christians is very complicated, as Christian-Muslim relations continue to be complicated today. In one sense, Christians had better treatment here than they would have under the Latin West. There were some Orthodox Christians that preferred to be under the rule of the Sultan's turban rather than the papal tiara. In another sense, if you're a Christian, you are a second-class citizen. You had to pay a tax for being a Christian. You would have to wear different clothing. You couldn't ride different pack animals into the city. So your life and your property and your belief practicing was secure, but there were also certain levels of society you could never rise to. We're standing in front of the Blue Mosque, known in Turkish as Sultanahmet. The Blue Mosque was built by Sultan Ahmet as an imperial mosque. Other sultans built a mosque in honor of conquering a large European state, and then they would plunder it, and that money would fund the building of the mosque. This one did not result in the conquest of a European state. It was built according to heavy taxation of the public, so there were a lot of problems and political turmoil as a result of its construction. But it was used by the Sultan to solidify his rule. So large mosques like these aren't just a site of worship, but they also make a political statement that the Sultan who builds it has political authority in addition to religious authority.
Finally, on our calendar, this Monday, the nation marks Martin Luther King Jr. Day. One musical group paying tribute to King is the a cappella ensemble Sweet Honey in the Rock. Kim Lawton caught up with Sweet Honey members after a performance at Voice of America in Washington.
Thousands were killed, thousands displaced.
The Grammy-nominated a cappella ensemble Sweet Honey in the Rock has been singing about racial inequality and social justice for more than 40 years. Members say there's as much to sing about today as there was when the group began in 1973.
It's a very painful situation that we find ourselves in, of looking at where we've been and perhaps making the wrong assumption that so much progress has been made when we see ourselves retreating right back to some of the same behaviors.
We're praying that we're all evolving, and we just have to keep those prayers out there, that we eventually understand the universality of humankind and embrace each other.
The group was created by African-American women who had worked together in the D.C. Black Repertory Theater. Their stated mission was to address critical issues of the day and to advocate for truth, justice, and compassion. Louise Robinson was one of the founding members.
We always want to be aware and tell stories because, you know, as we all know, if you don't remember what happened in the past, you can easily do it again.
The group performs a wide variety of musical genres, from spirituals, blues, folk, jazz, gospel, and world music. Often there is sign language interpretation.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Their name, Sweet Honey in the Rock, comes from a biblical passage, Psalm 81:16, which describes God's blessings as being so overflowing that honey will be found even in rocks. Spirituality has always infused the group's music, which has been embraced by people of many religious backgrounds.
To have a good sense of not necessarily a particular religiosity, but to have something that you embrace the earth, you embrace other people, that you understand that, you know, we're all going down this path together, and all the, I always say that, you know, like the rivers lead to the one great ocean.
On truth we stand.
The renewed national focus on race and the Black Lives Matter movement have inspired Sweet Honey members to reflect on the civil rights movement of 50 years ago.
We're at a point where a lot of people who were active in these movements are dying out. We have a fresh crop, a generation right now. We have a lot of people that, you know, really don't even know about Dr. King. And so I feel like it's an opportunity to kind of put something, when I say choice, this is, feels like a moment of choice.
The group has released a music video, Give Love, which highlights King's teachings about the power of love.
He said that I decided to stick with love because hate is too great of a burden to bear.
To be loving in a wider sense is, you know, pretty awesome. I don't think you have to be so courageous to be hateful, but to love in spite of, when I think of King, that's one of the things that really comes out for me. You have to really go deep and do it sincerely, and it can make a difference in anybody's life at any point in any day.
This love of immigration brings hatred, separation.
Sweet Honey members believe King's message of love is needed on many fronts.
Right now.
We see so much danger now in the type of propaganda that's being circulated today, and the danger, and the fact that so many large groups of people are embracing that. They're almost hungry for it, hungry for that hate, talk about hate this group and exclude that group and lump them all together and they're all bad.
I don't want no hold up at the river.
Sweet Honey in the Rock is releasing a new CD on January 22nd called Hashtag Love and Evolution. It's their first studio recording in 9 years. The project continues the group's trademark combination of spirituality and activism. The song Second Line Blues is about gun violence and those killed in senseless attacks. Group members say in their music, art and agenda always go hand in hand.
There's a purpose. There is an agenda in the song. There's a message they want to get across. There's something they feel very strongly about that they want to express, so you write a song about it.
Netanju Bolate Castle recalls writing one song based on a true event.
Somehow take all this information and turn it into something musical. That was, it was really very hard. But in other times, there are songs that come and it's just, wow, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. You just, you know, believe it just came from God.
And your spirit.
Yeah.
The women gather grind.
They believe that as women, and particularly women of color, it's important to process problems together.
People who are disenfranchised and who are marginalized in any way, we have to come together in our communities and address issues.
I've been thinking about how to talk about me.
But in addition to raising awareness about problems, group members say it's always been important to them to stress the positive as well.
When things get so bad or so heavy or so apparently bad, that makes you wake up and say, well, what, you know, choose. What do you want? What's your choice here? How are you going to live your life? How are you going to, you know, feed into it? Or are you going to bring something different to the table?
So much trouble in the world today. Life's so hard, it takes my breath away.
Their new CD has a song called IDK, But I'm LOL. The text abbreviations for I don't know, but...
I'm laughing out loud, I'm loving out loud, I'm living out loud, listening and learning out loud.
I'm so glad that
I'm so glad.
We
wanted to bring something to our fans and to our new listeners that would really, you know, resonate with them, make them, you know, moving to some music, ain't nothing wrong with that. So be able to move along, to sing along, to feel uplifted and feel good about it, even though life is challenging. We all have to take those steps to keep going. That's why we're still here.
I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
That's our program for now. I'm Hari Srinivasan. You can follow Religion and Ethics News Weekly on Twitter and Facebook and watch anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on the website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, Sweet Honey and the Rock sings, "I Don't Want No Trouble at the River."
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.